Jack wondered if being here made them feel better. Jack froze, his gaze fixed on a young woman who was standing across the street from him on the other side of the procession. She was tall, white, and blonde, though most of her hair was beneath a broad-brimmed sun hat, and her eyes and a good portion of her face were hidden behind dark sunglasses. He tried not to stare, but he couldn't help it, and she didn't seem to notice until she did. She quickly looked away. Jack didn't. Two more cars passed. She glanced back in Jack's direction as if to see if he was still looking. He was. Even behind sunglasses, Jack could almost feel their eyes meet. Slowly, she stepped back from the curb and then suddenly disappeared into the crowd. Jack was standing elbow to elbow with other onlookers with virtually no room to maneuver. He tried moving a half step forward, then sideways to catch another glimpse of the woman. She was gone.
"What's wrong?" asked Theo.
Jack settled back into his unassigned place on the crowded sidewalk. "Thought for sure I saw someone I knew over on the other side."
"Who?"
Jack paused, trying to make sense of it. "Mark Towson's sister." Chapter 27. The funeral procession ended at the City of Miami Cemetery. Leroy Highsmith told his limo driver to keep the air conditioning running, while Edith and Lamar Cousin readied themselves to step out into the hot afternoon sun. Highsmith sat facing Jamal's parents in the rear bench seat.
"Take all the time you need," said Highsmith. "No hurry."
The drive had been straight up Biscayne Boulevard, but the behind-the-scenes route to Jamal's burial in Miami's oldest and most historic cemetery had been more circuitous. City Cemetery sat on 10 acres north of downtown near historic Overtown Village, which by law was the only place the black laborers who built and worked the cemetery with shovels and pickaxes were allowed to live in Miami. As the tropical beauty of the site emerged, City Cemetery became the final resting place for pioneers like Julia Tuttle, the mother of Miami, and James Jackson, the city's first physician. Deeds to the few remaining plots had long since been issued, and burial was restricted to the deed owner or a family member. It took the active persuasion of a congresswoman, not to mention a generous cash offer from Leroy Highsmith to a 97-year-old deed holder, to secure an open plot for Jamal.
"God's love is great," said Jamal's mother. It had been her mantra to get through the worst day of a mother's life.
"Yes, he is," said Highsmith.
There had been no memorial service for Jamal, but rather a homegoing celebration. The theme was love, God's love, love of family, love from the community, love from total strangers. More than 2,000 people filled the church, and 1,000 others watched by closed-circuit television at the middle school gymnasium across the street, Jamal's old school. People who didn't even know Jamal traveled from as far away as Houston and Chicago. Florida's governor and U.S. senators stayed away, citing the respect for the family's privacy. But dozens of other dignitaries attended, including two members of Congress, state legislators, and a retired Florida Supreme Court justice. Highsmith's eulogy had been about love, not hate. The message was the same from so many others, from the mayor of Miami to Jamal's football coach in high school. It had been perfect, until the procession rolled past the University of Miami campus, where a group of white students proudly displayed their Greek letters and held posters proclaiming All Lives Matter, which, as a rejoinder to Black Lives Matter, was like patting black people on the head and saying, "Sure they do, kid.
You keep telling yourself that.
Are you ready? Asked Highsmith.
Edith sighed deeply. The ceremony had lasted almost 3 hours, but Highsmith had been in this position before, with mothers of other young black men, and he knew it wasn't exhaustion that kept her from opening the door. It was the thought of placing her 21-year-old son on the ground.
God's love is great, she said,
but this time her voice quaked. Highsmith climbed out first and held the door open. As if on cue, dozens of car doors opened in the long line of vehicles behind them. Highsmith and Jamal's father escorted Edith toward the black hearse ahead of them. Brandon Wall and five other Alpha brothers, as pallbearers, lifted the metal casket and placed it in a carriage drawn by two white horses.
Walk on,
the driver said with a gentle shake of the reins. The journey to the burial site began on a wide path of pea gravel, and in the solitude, little more could be heard than the rustling of the breeze and the crunching of stone beneath horse hooves and carriage wheels. They passed countless tombs, many adorned with angels, griffins, or cherubs. A few graves were brightened by fresh-cut flowers, but the most impressive splashes of pink, orange, and other flaming colors came from bougainvillea vines and hibiscus bushes that had been planted many years earlier, probably by mourners who had since found permanent rest here. They passed the large circle in honor of Julia Tuttle, but it was the second circle, a memorial to the Confederate dead erected by the United Daughters of the Confederacy, that drew a few sideways glances from the mostly African-American mourners. The walk continued along a shaded path until they reached the west section, which was the designated burial place for blacks in the days of strict segregation.
Whoa,
said the carriage driver, and the horses stopped. In silence, the pallbearers moved into position, lifted the casket, and carried it toward the open grave. Highsmith felt Edith's hand tighten around his. He and Lamar led her to a seat beneath the canvas canopy at graveside. Uncles, aunts, grandparents, and other family members filled in the remaining seats, while scores of others simply found a place to stand in the sun. The pallbearers placed the casket on the lift. Jamal's cousin placed 2 dozen red roses on top. The Reverend Elgin Maynard led them in prayer. The Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians 5:8, "To be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord." Today we know Jamal is present with the Lord. The plan was to keep the graveside service short, but that could not stop the tears from flowing. The home-going celebration had brought Jamal back to life, and Highsmith felt the family's pain as Jamal's mother stared down at the hole in the ground and the reality of his death. Jamal's aunt led the mourners in a final hymn. The Reverend Maynard closed in prayer. Jamal's father thanked everyone for coming. Edith remained seated, seemingly numb, as people started to walk away. They'd reached the end of the program, but Highsmith wasn't finished. He stood beside the coffin and spoke loud enough for everyone to hear.
"Remember his name," he said. "Remember Jamal, cousin."
People stopped. There were a few amens and other affirmations from the gathering.
"The first grave in the cemetery was dug in 1897, said Highsmith. "It was for a black man. We don't know his name. His burial was unrecorded. How many names have been forgotten? How many of our young black men?"
The response was louder and came from all over, the gist of it being too many, far too many. Highsmith plucked a rosebud from the bouquet of flowers on Jamal's casket. More than a dozen bouquets, hundreds of flowers adorned the setting.
"Everyone here loves Jamal," he said. "But we all know somebody else just like him. Somebody special with so much more life to live. A young black man who was supposed to be somebody, but whose life didn't matter to those who hate."
"Yes, sir," the crowd responded.
Highsmith dropped the single rose into the grave.
"Trayvon Martin," he said aloud.
Then he plucked another flower bud from the bouquet and dropped it into the grave.
"Michael Brown," he said.
And he continued to drop more flowers into the grave, saying the names of others.
"I want each of you to come forward," said Highsmith. "Drop a flower the way I just did. Say the name of a young man you remember. Jamal will not be forgotten, and we will remember the names of others, too."
A woman dressed in a bright blue skirt suit stepped forward.
"Jaden Jones," she said as she dropped a flower.
Others came forward and did the same, saying more names aloud. 15 minutes passed, then 20. Soon there were more flowers in the open grave than in the standing arrangements around the coffin. 30 minutes later, most of the crowd had dispersed. Jamal's parents and their closest friends remained seated in the first row of folding chairs in the shade of the canopy. Alone at the end of the row was a very old man in a wheelchair. It was Jamal's great-grandfather. Highsmith went to him and offered to help him forward.
"Is there someone you want to remember?"
asked Highsmith.
The old man nodded, his eyes clouded with tears and memories.
Highsmith wheeled him forward. The old man's hand shook as he reached for a red rose in the casket. He plucked it from the stem and squeezed the blossom in his fist. His head wobbled a bit as he prepared to speak.
"Rivers have secrets," he said. "So many secrets. We lost so many of our brothers and sisters in those waters. Nobody said nothing. No one was ever punished."
Highsmith hesitated, not sure what to think.
"Say it now, brother. Say his name."
The old man leaned forward and reached out as far as he could beyond his wheelchair.
"Willie James,"
he said, in a detached voice, one that seemed from long ago. And then he dropped the flower into his great-grandson's grave.
Chapter 28.
"Are you sure it was Mark's sister you saw?" asked Andy.
It was Saturday night, and Jack was with Andy at Cy's place. Theo had set them up at a choice table for two, right in front of the small stage, where live jazz music would begin at 10 o'clock.
"When I got Shelley on the phone, she denied being there," Jack said. "But Mark finally called me back and admitted it was her."
"So what's the story?"
The cocktail waitress brought drinks. They hadn't ordered yet, but Theo knew it was an IPA for Jack and a vodka tonic in a tall glass with lots of ice and extra lemon, not lime, for Andy.
"Mark wanted to be there," said Jack.
"He slept about 2 hours in the last 2 days, so Shelley drove. They left Gainesville at 4 o'clock this morning."
"You mean they were both at the funeral procession?"
Jack shook his head.
"It ended up being just Shelley." Mark came to his senses and realized that he could literally start a riot if somebody recognized him.
"So his sister went as his proxy?"
"Yeah," said Jack. "To what end, I don't know."
Andy squeezed the extra lemon into her cocktail.
"For some reason, Mark felt the need to be there. His sister drove 6 hours in a car and then stood on the sidewalk in his place. That's kind of sweet."
"Sweet?
Yeah, she said.
Step outside your work for just one minute. I'm talking purely as a family dynamic. Some siblings can't even sit in the same room with each other. Mark and his sister must be close. I think that's pretty great.
I could see that at the student conduct hearing when Shelley tried to testify. They're 2 years apart in school, but the difference in age is more like 18 months.
The musicians climbed on stage to set up for their gig. Uncle Cy wasn't playing tonight, but his spirit could still be felt. Jack signaled their waitress for a food menu.
Maybe Riley should have a brother, said Andy.
Jack froze, his index finger still in the air.
Really?
Maybe an older brother.
It had been a tough pregnancy with Riley. Until that moment, all indications were that she would be an only child. Jack reached across the table and held Andy's hand.
An older?
He started to say, and then he realized what she was saying.
You want to adopt?
Don't you?
Jack smiled, savoring a moment in a place filled with memories. The grand opening of Cy's place was where sparks had first started to fly for Jack and an FBI agent who'd sworn she'd never date a criminal defense lawyer. It was at Cy's place, on what Andy dubbed the second anniversary of Jack's 39th birthday, that Jack had put a ring on her finger. Jack raised his glass.
Here's to one bigger, happy family.
Andy smiled back.
I'll let you break the news to Max.
Chapter 29. At 9 o'clock Monday morning, Oliver Bolt and his senior trial counsel entered the grand jury room in the Live Oak courthouse. 18 grand jurors were sworn to secrecy and ready to hear the evidence. It was their job to decide whether probable cause existed to elevate a homicide investigation to a criminal prosecution.
Good morning, said Bolt, greeting his captive audience.
The state attorney's polite smile couldn't hide the pressure he was feeling. Public clamor for justice had reached a crescendo over the weekend, starting with the stabbing of three demonstrators on Friday night and continuing through the funeral service on Saturday. By Sunday night, media vans and cable news teams had staked out positions around the courthouse in anticipation of an indictment or a revolt. Bolt and his team worked nonstop with the Suwanee County Sheriff's Department and other agencies. On Monday, he was ready to go. Bolt took the entire morning to explain his theory of the case and the evidence, including the medical examiner's report. Step one in any grand jury proceeding was to give the jurors a reasonable basis to conclude that a crime had been committed. Easy enough in this case. Step two was more difficult. Connect the would-be defendant to the crime. Immediately after lunch, the star witness was on the stand, sworn and ready to testify. Senior trial counsel Marsha Weller did the honors.
Your name, sir?
Bain Robinson.
The witness shifted nervously.
Apart from the prosecutors, jurors, and court reporter, Bain was alone in the room. A grand jury witness has no right to have his attorney present. With just a few quick questions, the prosecutor established him as a fraternity brother and close friend of Mark Towson, someone the jurors could believe. A proper degree of reluctance and hesitation preceded each blow delivered to his friend. Mr. Robinson, are you aware of any text messages between Mark Towson and Jamal Cousin?
Yes, I am.
Weller stopped him. With no judge in a grand jury proceeding, a prosecutor could in effect hit pause and explain things at her discretion. She presented a copy of the strange fruit text to the jurors and allowed them a minute to absorb it. Bolt had referenced the text in his morning presentation, and most jurors had admitted to having seen it earlier in the media and on the internet. Nonetheless, several jurors winced at the larger-than-life image on the projection screen. Weller continued her examination of the witness.
Mr. Robinson, have you ever seen this text from Mark Towson to Jamal Cousin?
Yes, I have.
When did you first see it?
A few minutes after Mark sent it.
Were you with him when he sent it?
No, but I was at the same party. We were both at the Theta House. Mark showed it to me after he sent it.
Did Mr. Towson tell you that he sent it, or did he tell you that someone else used his phone to send it?
He said he sent it.
What was your reaction, Mr. Robinson?
I told Mark that it was a really stupid thing to do and that he should delete it from his cell phone.
Did he delete it?
Yes.
What happened next?
We both went back to the party and talked to our friends. That kind of thing.
Did you tell anyone about the text from Mr. Towson to Jamal?
No. But I kept thinking about it.
Did you do anything about it?
Yes. About 30 minutes later, I texted Jamal.
The prosecutor paused for another explanation to the grand jury.
Ladies and gentlemen, phone records confirm a text message from Bane Robinson to Jamal Cousin. However, the actual text was deleted from Mr. Cousin's phone. So, Mr. Robinson, if you please, can you tell us what you said in your message?
I don't remember the exact words, but it was an apology.
An apology for what?
On behalf of the Theta Pi Omega fraternity, I apologize for the offensive message sent earlier by our president, Mark Towson.
An elderly woman seated in the front row raised her hand. Unlike trial jurors, grand jurors were permitted to ask questions. The prosecutor recognized her.
Excuse me, but is this witness related to the Bane Robinson, whose name is on the College of Agriculture at the University of Florida?
The prosecutor allowed the witness to answer.
That's my grandfather, said Bane.
Well, the old woman said with approval, your granddaddy would be right proud of you, young man.
Thank you, ma'am.
The prosecutor smiled. Nothing like a friendly question to move things right along.
Mr. Robinson, let's jump ahead 6 days on the timeline to the following Friday night. The night that Jamal Cousin went missing.
Chapter 30. Jack and Theo were on a midnight ride in an old wooden rowboat, propelled upriver by the quiet hum of an electric trolling motor. Grand jury proceedings were supposed to be secret by law, and while the state attorney wasn't officially talking, the media was already reporting that Bane Robinson had cut a deal and that Mark Towson was the lone target. Jack had no access to the evidence at this stage, so he decided to recreate it, at least in his mind. He wanted to visit the scene of the crime. Their guide was Owen McFay, a local gator hunter who knew the local rivers after dark better than anyone. He rarely smiled, and when he did, his crooked teeth showed the stains of chewed tobacco. He reminded Jack of the redneck version of Captain Ahab. No peg leg, but his left ring finger was missing, lost to the snap of a bull gator's mammoth jaw, and 3,000 pounds of pressure per square inch. McFay was the undisputed go-to guy for night trips on the river. Theo went along, in his words, to make sure Jack didn't end up like the cast in Deliverance. Having stood beside him at that funeral procession, Jack knew the reason ran deeper.
"How much farther?" asked Jack.
"Just a bit," said McFay. "Got it full throttle."
Headed upriver, even with a gentle current, full throttle on this rig meant throwing a wake that was little more than a V-shaped ripple. They were on the Santa Fe, a true blackwater river that received the cooler waters of the spring-fed Itchituckney. The river was about 75 feet wide in these parts, with willow-swept banks that sloped to depths better suited to canoes and kayaks than motorboats. Somewhere in the darkness were egrets and alligators. The tall cypress trees were mere silhouettes, their moss-clad limbs barely visible against the starlit sky.
"There's the boat launch I told you all about,"
said McFay as he steered toward the riverbank.
"This is probably where they would have pulled up in their car."
"They must have left tracks in the sand," said Jack. Crime scene investigators took an impression from Mark's tires.
"Did they get a match?"
asked Theo. "I guess only the grand jury knows for now." The boat continued its crawl toward a wooden pier that jutted out into the river. A small cottage was visible in the clearing along the bank.
"Yonder is where the boat was stole from," said McFay.
Fastened to the pilings at the end of the pier was a 14-foot aluminum fishing boat. Beside it was a larger fiberglass flats boat with a small Johnson outboard.
"That little one without the motor is like the one reported stolen on the night Jamal was lynched," said McFay.
Theo glanced back toward the launch and then at the pier.
"So they drove here with Jamal in the trunk of the car, stole a rowboat from this pier, and took him up river on the Santa Fe and then into the Itchituckney."
"That's the story being leaked to the media," said Jack. McFay steered back toward the middle of the river.
"Want to see where they took him?"
Theo gazed out over the bow.
"That's what we're here for,"
he said in a tentative voice. They rode in silence for another mile. Private piers and cottages on the banks disappeared as they entered the state park. The forest thickened, and the perfume-like scent of surrounding water lilies sweetened the night. The boat stopped, the electric motor went quiet, and all was still. Eerily still. The surest signs of life were the chorus of sounds from unseen creatures of the night. The rhythmic belch of bullfrogs, the midnight squawk of egrets and ospreys. At any moment, however, that peaceful pulse of nature could spike into tachycardia. Or so McFay had warned them. He switched on his spotlight, and Jack immediately understood. Sleek and dark saurian bodies lay perfectly still, concealed in flat water that was black as ink. They looked dead, except for the countless sets of eyes lurking just above the waterline on the flooded banks. Primeval red dots caught in the sweep of McFay's handheld spotlight. There was hunger in that eerie ruby shine.
"Some folks say the Itchituckney is too cold for gators," said McFay. "I say you need to know where to look. It's the young uns, especially, who swim up river from the Santa Fe, where the big bulls eat anything under 6 feet. Better to be a chilly little gator on the Itchituckney than a warm dinner on the Santa Fe, I reckon."
6 feet is little?" asked Theo.
"Compared to a 12-foot bull it is," said McFay. "There's some males in these parts bigger than this boat."
Jack and Theo exchanged uneasy glances. McFay looked up to the glowing half-moon in the clear night sky.
"We're just about high tide. River's up enough for us to float right up next to the tree if you want."
There was no mistaking what he meant by the tree.
"Yeah,"
said Jack.
"Closer."
McFay switched on the trolling motor and they eased toward the bank.
"I'd never be motoring like this if we was hunting gator," he said.
The electric motor was quiet enough not to scare away the wildlife, but only to a point. They were 10 feet from the flooded banks when a bull gator spooked. It triggered a chain reaction of splashing and thrashing which made McFay grumble.
"This is what your amateur hunters do," he said. "Those gators will stay down for hours."
"Hours?"
"Sure. They can stay down all night if they have to."
Jack watched the waters go still, smooth as black ice again. No sign of alligators.
Not to be gruesome, but is it possible that a body could be left hanging here overnight and not be attacked by a gator?
Sure, if you spook these gators the way I just did. Now, you leave the body here more than 24 hours. Well, that wouldn't be a pretty sight.
The hull bumped up against the massive trunk of a fallen cypress tree. McFay roped up and steadied the boat. Directly above, through the looms of trees not fallen, the moon shone down on them.
"This is the spot," said McFay.
Jack felt chills. It was like a scene out of a horror movie, and he could only imagine what Theo was thinking as the image flashed through his mind. The tying of Jamal's hands and feet. The placement of the noose. The tossing of the rope up around one of these sturdy limbs. And then...
"How much did Jamal weigh?"
asked Theo. Jack wasn't sure, but he'd seen photographs of Jamal. I'd say 180, maybe a little more.
Was it high tide like this the night this happened?
That much Jack had confirmed.
Yeah.
What are you getting at, Theo?
Let's all three of us stand up in this boat. Come on, said Theo, rising. Get up.
Jack and McFay complied, but the boat immediately started to wobble, and Jack felt like he might go overboard. They quickly returned to the safety of their seats.
Now, said Theo. Imagine Mark Towson and his fraternity brothers standing up in this boat trying to string up Jamal, who I'm guessing was kicking and fighting.
Unless they knocked him out, said Jack.
Or drowned him first, said McFay.
Jack latched onto McFay's thought. The charts I saw say it was low tide when the body was found hanging from the tree. What's the difference between high tide and low tide on this river?
3 feet.
Said McFay. So Jamal's body could have been at least partly in the water at midnight, but hanging entirely above the water by 11 o'clock the next morning. Is that right? Jack asked.
That's possible, said McFay.
Is that good or bad for you, Jack?
Asked Theo. Jack thought about it. I don't know.
Could be good. Or could be bad, said Theo.
How?
If Jamal was drowned and just left here floating in the water with a rope around his neck, Mark could have done this all by himself. Didn't need nobody to help him get Jamal under control. Didn't need another set of hands to hoist him up in the air while standing in a wobbly little rowboat. It's an easy one-man job. That would be bad, right?
Jack was thinking of the media reports that Mark alone was the target of the grand jury. Yeah, he said. That would definitely be bad.
Chapter 31. Just after sunrise, Percy Donovan left his fraternity house for Live Oak. Brandon Wall rode with him. The grand jury had subpoenaed 2 witnesses from the black fraternities, Percy from Kappa and Brandon from Alpha. They were scheduled to testify back-to-back on Tuesday morning, starting at 9 a.m. The state attorney and a senior trial counsel wanted to meet with them an hour before the start of the grand jury proceedings. Their testimony would not take long, he promised. The goal was to have them back in Gainesville in time for afternoon classes. Missing class was the least of Percy's worries. "I'm kind of nervous," said Percy. They were having breakfast at Denny's just off the Live Oak exit on I-75. With them in the booth was Ted T.C. Calloway, an attorney retained by the National Panhellenic Council, the body that coordinated activities between and among the many local chapters of the 5 fraternities and 4 sororities that made up the Divine Nine, historically black Greek letter organizations founded between 1906 and 1963.
"Yeah, I was nervous, too, before Towson's expulsion hearing," said Brandon.
Calloway poured a little sugar into his coffee mug.
"Nothing to worry about."
"Then why do we need a lawyer?" asked Percy.
Nobody should go before a grand jury without talking to a lawyer. When I heard you boys were subpoenaed, I called National and volunteered my time. We're just being smart. Percy, how's the Kappa brother who got stabbed Friday night?
He's fine. Took 16 stitches to sew up his arm.
I'm not surprised, said Calloway. I saw the photos that got posted online. His shirt was covered in blood.
We were scared, said Percy.
Calloway stirred his coffee.
You know what else I noticed on his shirt?
Percy blinked. It was the lawyer's change in tone more than the question that puzzled him.
No, I don't. I noticed that he was wearing Jamal's Greek letters.
Yeah, some of the brothers in our house did that to show support.
You know that's against the rules. To wear the letters of another house.
We weren't pretending to be from Alpha. Just showing unity.
I'm sure his intentions were good, said Calloway. But when someone sees that photo online, they just assume that an Alpha brother got in a knife fight.
He wasn't in a knife fight. He got attacked by a skinhead.
Well, let's be fair, Percy.
One of the three people stabbed was white. So somewhere in the crowd, there was a brother with a knife.
It wasn't us.
I understand. But unfortunately, the caption beneath the photo doesn't say that your fraternity brother wasn't in a knife fight, and it doesn't say that he's not actually a member of the Alpha House. So going forward, let's all have an agreement that each house wears its own letters. Can you send that message back to your Kappa brothers, Percy?
Percy glanced at Brandon, who looked away.
By any chance, are you an Alpha, Mr. Calloway? Asked Percy.
I am. Cornell. 1981.
Suddenly the business card that Calloway had shared with Percy at the start of the meeting made its impression. Calloway was a partner at the largest law firm in Washington, D.C. Alpha boasted plenty of alumni like him. The most famous alum from Percy's house was Huey P. Newton, co-founder of the Black Panther Party in the 1960s.
Sure thing, said Percy. We'll wear our own letters.
The meeting with Oliver Bolt and Marsha Weller was in a conference room at the office of the state attorney. Percy assumed correctly that the focus of his testimony would be on the discovery of Jamal's body while tubing down the Ishtukni River. The state attorney, however, was working another angle that Percy had not anticipated.
That's my understanding that you were in charge of organizing the trip down the river, Bolt said. Is that right, Percy?
On the fraternity side, I was. There was a sister at Delta Sigma Theta who reached out to sororities.
Did you invite any white fraternities? Asked Bolt.
No, this was an event for black Greek letter organizations at UF and FSU.
Okay, but it wasn't a secret event, right?
Percy wasn't sure what he meant.
Secret?
No. You sent out emails, posted the event on Facebook, that sort of thing?
Uh-huh. And there were flyers posted in all the black Greek letter organizations at UF and FSU. I assume they all mentioned it at chapter meetings, too.
That's what I'm getting at, said Bolt. The goal was to get the word out far and wide, right?
Right.
So later this morning, when you testify before the grand jury, if Ms. Weller was to ask you if it was possible that Mark Towson knew that dozens of black college students would be floating down the Ishtukni River on that Saturday morning, what would your answer be, Percy?
It was obvious what the prosecutor wanted to hear, but Percy gave him the truth. Honestly, I'd have to say, I don't know if he did or didn't.
I'm just asking if it's possible, said Bolt.
Anything's possible, said Percy.
Exactly, said Bolt.
It is possible. That's your answer.
No, like I said, my answer is that I have no idea whether...
Percy, said Calloway in a firm voice, Mr. Bolt is simply trying to be helpful here. It is possible.
Percy didn't like anyone putting words in his mouth.
It's also possible that Mark Towson didn't do it.
Whoa, said the state attorney.
This is not a time to be flip, said Calloway.
I'm just saying, said Percy. Right before that riot started on Friday night, I saw him come walking out of the Theta house. One of the cops, he was black, was interviewed on TV and said that Towson was just coming out to talk with the guy with the loudspeaker, which was me. That doesn't sound like a racist who just lynched the president of the Alpha House.
Maybe he was coming out to kick your ass, said Brandon.
I doubt it, said Percy. That would be suicide.
Over the last few days, I've been thinking a lot about that night. One thing that sticks out clearly in my mind is the skinhead who shoved me up against the wall shoved me so hard that it actually knocked me out for about 30 seconds. You know what he said to me? He said, strange fruit, motherfucker. You're next.
It was a chilling statement, and neither Calloway nor the prosecutors had an immediate response. Brandon spoke up.
Hope you got a good look at him before you went out.
It's what I heard that's important, said Percy. And I don't mean just the words. It was the way he said it. At first I thought he was just a drunk skinhead trying to scare me. But I keep hearing it over and over in my head. It's like he was telling me, I got Jamal. I'm coming for you next.
The state attorney said,
I'm sorry you had that experience.
But your first instinct was probably right.
Most likely it was a drunken skinhead trying to scare you.
But it's possible it wasn't, said Percy, turning the state attorney's tactic against him. Right.
That drew a look of disapproval from Calloway.
Percy, I don't know what you're trying to accomplish here, but if you really feel threatened, fill out a police report.
Yes, said the state attorney, but do it on a confidential basis.
You want me to keep this quiet? Asked Percy, incredulous.
I want all of us to act responsibly, said Bolt.
History is our teacher.
You're nowhere near old enough to remember when Ted Bundy snuck into the Chi Omega house at FSU one night and bludgeoned two young women to death. 12 years later, Danny Rowling went on a killing spree at the University of Florida and killed 5 students, decapitating 1 girl. It was absolute terror. Parents pulled students out of those schools by the hundreds.
Those were serial killers, said Percy.
That's my point, said Bolt.
One thing you can be sure of with a serial killer, there will be a next victim. Right now, law enforcement has absolutely no reason to believe that anyone else is in danger. Your story, a threat that you're next, will create panic.
Black students will disenroll and head home by the busload.
People should know what's happening, said Percy.
The state attorney glanced at Calloway.
Can I speak to you in the hallway for a minute? Asked Bolt.
Absolutely. Calloway rose and the two men stepped out. The state attorney's senior trial counsel went with them, closing the door behind her, leaving Percy and Brandon alone in the conference room.
Is it just me? Said Percy. Or is everyone more concerned about keeping people calm than keeping people safe?
Fuck Bolt, said Brandon.
Go public. If you don't, I will.
Cool. And fuck Calloway too, said Brandon.
If the Kappa brothers want to wear armbands with alpha letters to show unity with Jamal, you wear them. Thanks, man. We cool, homie?
They fist bumped to seal it.
Yeah, man, said Percy. We cool.
Chapter 32. Jack and Theo stopped for breakfast before the trip back to Miami. The Dixie Grill in the historic section of Live Oak had been family-run since Florida's Dixiecrats helped elect Eisenhower president. The chef liked to call the cuisine New South, but the service was pure Old South. Friendly from the moment you walk through the door, quick to refill your coffee mug, and no rush on your meal. Jack had cheese grits and biscuits. Theo ordered the pork chops and egg special with a side of hotcakes, bacon, sausage, and potatoes. Jack watched in amazement as the waitress unloaded the line of plates from her arms and laid out the breakfast spread before them.
"Anything else I can bring you?"
she asked.
"No, ma'am," said Theo.
"Good thing," she said with a smile.
"We're almost out of food."
She stepped away and Theo dug in. Jack ate slowly, allowing time for the pat of butter to melt into his biscuit, instinctively looking up and taking notice each time a customer entered the restaurant. A truck driver, an elderly couple, probably retirees. A postal worker in uniform. It was a slice of Suwannee County, its makeup as random as the grand jury that had been summoned to the courthouse to weigh the evidence against Jack's client.
"You in the mob or the CIA?" asked Theo. "You're checking out every person who walks through the door." "Busted."
It was a trial lawyer's compulsion to get a feel for the jury pool in any town in which he might soon try a case. The door opened again, but this time, it wasn't a stranger.
"Hey, there's our river guide," said Jack.
"Am I wrong, or are those the same clothes he had on last night?" asked Theo.
Owen McFay was wearing blue denim coveralls and a flannel shirt.
"I think he changed his cap," said Jack.
This one was camouflage in color and said Duck Dynasty. The hostess greeted McFay like a regular, and as she led him toward a small table by the window, he spotted Jack and Theo. A smile came to his face, and he walked over to say hello.
"Well, 2 points for the city, boys. Y'all found the best breakfast joint in Live Oak."
"We're learning,"
said Jack.
"Y'all like catfish?"
The way he'd asked, Jack thought he might actually have one on him.
"I do," said Theo.
"Come back for supper, then. Try Chef Robbie's squirrel fishing, which is a fancy name for fried catfish and pecan breading. Comes with tomato gravy, grits, and 2 hush puppies. Man, that's good eating."
"Next time for sure," said Jack.
McFay lowered himself into a crouch and rested his sun-leathered forearms on the tabletop, as if he had a secret to share, eye to eye.
"Can I tell y'all something?"
"Sure," said Jack. He checked over his shoulder, making sure no one was listening.
"There are certain things folks around here don't talk about much. And when we got on the river last night talking about what happened to Jamal's cousin, it got me thinking about stories I used to hear as a boy."
Jack set his coffee mug aside.
"You mean stories about lynching?"
McFay said.
"Some true. Some weren't, I suppose. There's one I always remember, and I believe it's true, 'cause my daddy told it to me."
Jack glanced at Theo, who looked on the verge of tearing McFay's face off.
"Your daddy lynched a man?"
Theo asked.
"No, no, no," said McFay. "He was a loading dock foreman at the Bond Howell Lumber Company. One morning, these 3 white men pulled up in a car. They came looking for this black fellow who worked in the sawmill, a man named Howard James. No, James Howard.
What did they want?
They just took him. Put him in the car and drove off. Daddy said he never did come back to work.
They lynched him?
Asked Theo.
I can't say, but this much is for sure. 4 days later, the sheriff pulled the body of a 15-year-old black boy from the river. People say it was Mr. Howard's son.
Were the three white men arrested?
McFay looked at Jack as if he had three heads.
This is a long time ago. During the Second World War. There's no legal case. But here's the important point. The story goes that the boy was hogtied. The man tied his hands and feet and threw him in the river.
Lynched by drowning, said Jack.
Uh-huh, said McFay.
Maybe like they'd done to Jamal. Hogtied him and drowned him in the river.
Jack considered it. You think there's a connection between the two?
I don't know. If there is, it'll take someone a lot smarter than me to figure it out. All I'm telling you is that the one made me think of the other. And I thought you should know.
I appreciate that, said Jack.
Glad to help.
McFay rose and shook their hands.
Y'all try that catfish. I mean it.
We will, said Jack.
Jack's cell rang as McFay walked away. It was the state attorney, so he took the call.
Jack, I know your father was a man of his word, said Bolt. Is it safe for me to assume the same about you?
It is, said Jack.
Good.
I need a yes or no answer. Will Mark Townsend agree to stay put in Gainesville until I tell you that there is no possibility he will be indicted by a grand jury?
Jack knew what that meant. The prosecutor already had enough evidence to arrest his client, but he was willing to delay the arrest until the grand jury finished its work, as long as he knew exactly where Mark was.
You have my word on it, said Jack.
The prosecutor thanked him. Jack hung up, and Theo immediately sensed that it wasn't good news.
What was that about?
Asked Theo.
Looks like we may get to taste that catfish sooner than I thought, said Jack.
Chapter 33 Mark Towson was home for lunch. His mother sat at the kitchen table with him. It was hard to swallow the notion that his next meal might be in a jail cafeteria, sitting across from a drug dealer, a rapist, or worse.
How do you feel today, Mom?
His mother had slept almost until noon. Mark had taken the call from Jack while she was asleep. A looming indictment was a significant development, but Mark had decided to tell the family later as a group, when they could support each other. He saw no point in giving his mother more worries. He'd heard her walking the house most of the night, midnight, 2 o'clock, and again around 4 a.m. Mark was not the only one having trouble sleeping, and she needed the rest more than he did. Her post-mastectomy cancer recurrence was local, but the recommended treatment was systemic. The oncologist wanted her to start chemotherapy before the end of the week.
I'm doing okay, she said with a weak smile.
Mark swallowed the last of his ham and cheese sandwich, chugged the last of his lemonade, and took the dishes to the sink. There was a knock at the front door, more like a pounding.
I'll get it,
said Mark. He went to the foyer and opened the door. It was his friend Cooper Bartlett. His hair was uncombed, he needed a shave, and his eyes were like falcon slits. His little Mazda Miata was parked in the driveway, but his T-shirt was soaked with sweat, as if he'd just run a 10K.
I gotta talk to you, said Cooper breathless.
Could you just come from the gym?
No, man. I just ran for my life. Barely made it to my car.
What?
I was at McDonald's. Some punks recognized me from the pictures of you, me, and Bane that are all over the internet. They were gonna kick my ass. Dude, we gotta talk.
Mark didn't want his mother to see Cooper in this state. He stepped out onto the front porch and closed the door, but he soon realized that the porch wasn't a good place to talk. The demonstrators in the cul-de-sac had been marching silently all morning, but whenever someone stepped outside the house, the chant resumed.
What do we want? Justice! When do we want it? Now!
Cooper's expression tightened.
Mark, we really gotta talk someplace private.
The front door opened and Mark's mother stood in the doorway.
Oh, hello, Cooper.
Hello, Mrs. Townsend.
The chant from the crowd grew louder.
Boys, please come inside so the neighbors don't have to hear that.
We were just leaving, Mrs. Townsend.
Apparently, Cooper didn't want to have their conversation within earshot of Mark's mother. Neither did Mark.
That's right,
said Mark.
Where are you going?
She asked. Thankfully, Cooper had an answer.
I found a place to live. Mark said he'd help me move in. Right, Mark?
Right,
said Mark, playing along.
We'll be quick about it.
She didn't seem pleased about him going anywhere, but it was hard to say no to relocating a friend after his fraternity house had been burned down.
Okay. Take your new cell phone with you.
Mark's cell was still in police custody, and its replacement had come with a free upgrade. Woo-hoo.
I will,
he said.
And come straight home when you finish.
Mark promised he would, kissed her goodbye, and followed Cooper to his car.
What do we want? Justice!
Mark slammed the passenger door shut, and Cooper got behind the wheel. The keys jingled on the ring, and Mark noticed that his friend's hand was shaking as he turned the ignition on.
Cooper, you okay?
I'm fine,
he said as they backed out of the driveway. The group of demonstrators parted to let the car pass, but apparently not fast enough for Cooper. One had to jump out of the way, shouting angrily as Cooper slammed the transmission into gear and burned rubber on the way out. Only then, in the confined car, did Mark smell the alcohol from Cooper's sweaty t-shirt.
Have you been drinking, dude?
Just listen,
he said, as they continued down the street.
You and me are fucked.
At the stop sign, he slowed down but didn't stop, rolling through it in his hurry to get away from Mark's house.
Bane testified to the grand jury.
I know.
It was on the news last night.
Although grand jury proceedings were secret, it was standard procedure for reporters to stand outside the grand jury room to see who entered to testify.
Do you know what he said?
Asked Cooper.
No.
Jack told me that all grand jury testimony is under seal until the court releases the transcript.
I bet he told them.
Told them what?
What I wrote in my text.
Mark froze.
You texted Jamal?
You knew that?
My phone number was in Jamal's phone records.
So was mine, Cooper, but I never texted him.
Cooper punched the steering wheel in anger. As for the text, it clearly had not been his intention to tell Mark something he didn't already know.
Fuck!
Cooper, take me back home.
No, there's more.
Take me home.
Oliver Bolt talked to me.
He wanted me to testify against you.
Mark was torn, not sure whether to listen or not.
He's real heavy-handed,
said Cooper.
He says to me, you know what happens to guys like you and Mark Townsend in prison? Two white frat boys accused of lynching a black guy?
The thought had kept Mark awake most of the night. He'd been trying very hard not to let his mind go there. Cooper glanced in the rearview mirror. his eyes widening with fear.
It's them again. Who? The guys from McDonald's. They followed me.